This is Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Tuesdays and Thursdays from 10 a.m.
You're on Rally Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. We have with us this morning our Professor Gardening Guru, none other than here Professor Dr. Magnum Cum Laude, Ducks, Wally Richards. Good morning, Wally.
My God, have I got to put all those initials after my name?
Yes.
Now? Oh, my Magnus and God knows what. Yeah. Good Magnum morning, everybody. Home. Yeah, yeah.
Well, you're our gardening guru. We're going to cover off quite a few things today, so we're going to get moving, Wally.
Yep.
First up, I noticed around Queenstown, Arrowtown area, a lot of people have leaves that they got lying over from autumn, and they're sort of rotting and damp. What should they be doing with them?
Leaves are a valuable source of minerals, and they can be turned quite easily into leaf mold. Leaf mold, in the old days, what we used to do, we would make with wire netting a hammock, which would hang between a couple of trees, right? You might recall those. And then you'd rake up all the leaves and you'd put them into this hammock and leave them there to break down, right?
I've never seen that.
Yeah, you're not old enough, that's why.
No, clearly.
Yeah. The best way to do it these days is two ways. One's quicker than the other. First one, which you do, is you collect all the leaves up and you get those black plastic rubbish bags and you stuff the leaves into the plastic bag. You could, at the same time as you're doing that, spray the leaves now and again with some microcin. Microcin feeds the microbes, which will break down the leaves quicker. And once you've got the bag fairly full, tie it off, and then with a little screwdriver or nail, 4-inch nail, poke lots of little holes all around the bag so it can get some oxygen in to the breakdown process. And then you throw the bag into a nice sunny spot that's where it doesn't matter. When people come around to visit, you've got all these black bags there. Every now and again, you pick up a bag, give it a shake, turn it over, and lay it back down there. That will break down over a period of time. But there's a very quick way to do it. And that is you, and part of your lawn, which is a bit scruffy, and you're not, 100% worried about, you lay the leaves down, and with your rotary lawnmower at a low height, you run over the leaves and cut them all up. You catch them in the catcher. Now, those broken leaves, once again, go back into your black plastic rubbish bag, holes, etc., tied off, and they will be very quick. Within 6 months or so, you'll have beautiful leaf mold, which is kind of like a soil, and which you can use in conjunction with your potting mixes, because it's going to be great for that. You can use it as a seed raising mix, add a little bit of sand or vermiculite to it for drainage. Beautiful, lovely, crumbly leaf mold. Can't beat it.
So leaving them on the ground?
Oh, if you don't do anything, they will rot down. Now, I have a situation where I have some deciduous trees from the neighbour which overshadow onto my chook run, right? And where the chooks are most of the time, which is a slightly lower level, with the rain, it gets very wet and muddy, right? Then next to that, slightly higher level where the chooks don't go so much and it's good drainage, what has happened this season, the leaves that fell in the damp area, they've already gone. History. Within a month.
The chooks take care of them.
No, well, possibly their movement on there, but it's the mud, of course, has got and the chook manure going into that, feeding the microbes, and the just breakdown is so quick because of the moisture aspect as well. On the dry area, the leaves are still there. They're slowly breaking down, and they will take probably another 2 or 3 months before they disappear completely. The interesting thing is, like, if you mow your lawn and you don't use a catcher, it looks pretty shoddy for a day or two or three, and then it's all of its clippings are gone. Things go back in the soil so quickly. And that's one of the things that I suggest too, particularly in the warmer weather, when you're weeding, is to cut the weeds off with a carving knife under the soil, just underneath, and lay them on the ground. They will soon disappear and feed your good plants around them. So your weeds are a big advantage if you use them properly.
Mm. So the leaves would go good in the chook coop and in the chook run.
You mean like using them instead of sawdust or wood shavings?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you could if they're dry, yeah.
Okay.
And then the chooks in the chook house, that of course, at night time they'll have their toilets on it, and then when you muck out the chook house, you'll have leaves and chook manure mixed again, just like wood shavings or sawdust.
Mm. How often do you clean out your chicken coop?
Whenever I need some manure for the garden.
Okay.
So I'm lazy that way.
On a need basis.
On a need to do.
My chook run has become like barren. The chooks dig holes in it and seem to like it, and I throw the kitchen scraps on it and they demolish it and the dog roll.
Right.
And I got the water and the feed, but it's just barren. Is that okay?
Yeah. Yeah. Because anything that grows here, they'll eat.
Yes.
They keep it barren like that. I remember one time when I had free ranging chooks at the backyard of one of my houses that I lived in, and the backyard got horrible looking. So I thought, oh, this instant grass, you know, it comes in rolls and you lay that down.
Yes.
I thought, I'll tidy the whole place up. So I bought a pile of this grass and lay it all down.
And it's not cheap.
Look, it looked beautiful. 2 days later, it's all gone. The chooks had eaten the bloody lot.
That was an expensive feed.
Yes, it was, yes. But it was a good exercise.
In the garden these times, you can see moss and what is it, a sort of lichen growing on the grass and on the concrete.
Liverwort.
Is it liverwort?
That green flat thing, which looks, it's, how can I describe it? It looks like a piece of green leather.
Yeah, on the grass.
Well, no, it can grow on the fences, on your roof, on the glass of your glass house, on furniture, on soil, like liverwort. And when it reaches maturity, it sends up little wee helmets like mushrooms, right?
Okay.
And that's where the spore come out and spread again. Soil in the garden, it just spreads and spreads, and it's not good for the plants. There's in lawns at this time of the year with the wet weather, you tend to get sphagnum type moss, and that's the one that's looks like sphagnum moss because it is sphagnum moss. Then you've got on trees, you've got lichen. Now that's that little feathery looking stuff that grows on the side of trees, etc.
Is that a problem?
Oh, yeah, because over time, with the moisture retention of it, it will ring bark a tree.
Oh.
And the tree Because it rots into the bark, and particularly on a tree that's got very thin bark, it can be quite, it's good for a period of time, but then it can be dangerous. We have a product called Wally's Moss and Liverwort Control, right? Now, it's got two uses and two rates. First of all, for sphagnum-type moss and for liverwort, you use it at 50 mils per litre, and you have to adjust your nozzle of your sprayer to make a jet. So it has to be forced into those two biophiliates, right? Lower plant life forms are called biophiliates, by the way. So you go and shoot it, and that is very effective. At over a period of a week or two, you'll see it dying off and good to go. Then for green algae, which you see on the path, and so for very dangerous, having algae on your path, because it makes it slippery. Then that can be on furniture and the lichen on the trees. You use Wally's Moss and Liverwort Control at just 25 mils per litre, and you use it as a spray, not as a jet. So you spray to wet those biophiliates, and they will die over a period of a week or two and make it clean. It doesn't hurt plants. Now, I had a guy the other day contact me, and he said, I've got this patch of my lawn which has died. And I said, really? And then he came back to me a bit later on. He said, I know what I did. I'd used one of those forget things, you know, that they talk about on the roof. And he said, some of it got onto my lawn and killed my lawn. Okay, not good. Besides, another aspect of this is it doesn't hurt plants, moss and liverwort control. So if you inadvertently spray a plant or anything, it won't do any damage. Though on the label, we suggest 30 minutes after using it, just give the plant a light watering to make sure, to be sure. The beauty of a concentrate like this is opposed to some products out there that do similar sort of jobs, but they come in like 5 litres or, you know, big packs. And most of that in that 5 litres is water. So yes, you pay a lot of money for water, which you can get from the tap if you use a concentrate like Moss and Liverwort Control. It works out much cheaper in the long run.
Good tip. Run that past me again. I've got it in the lawn. What's the mix?
Oh, if it's sphagnum moss in the lawn, you would use it at 50 mils per litre and turn your nozzle to make a jet, and you shoot it, right?
Okay.
And then after it's died back a week or so later, then you can go back and hit the pieces you missed. Okay. I've found from personal experience using on liverwort and et cetera that the biophilates don't return as quick as they would do. It seems to have an extended period of control. Okay. Yeah.
And when you're shooting it as a jet, do you have to wet the whole plant, or just getting it in a spot is enough, it knocks it?
No, you're basically covering the whole plant.
Whole plant. Got it. Yeah. Oh, wow. And then let's say it all dies. You go back a week later, you kill it again. What would you then do for your lawn, because you've got a bare patch? Would you just leave the lawn to spread there, or would you seed it?
Well, ideally, a seeding, yes, and just get some new seed from the garden centre and sprinkle that on, if it's a bare patch. Quite often, the lawn, the little sphagnum moss in the lawn. Now, here's another one too. They'd say sulfate of iron, you use that to kill moss in the lawn. Yes, it does. It kills the top of it, but it burns it, but it doesn't kill it.
Right? Mm.
And when you use sulfate of iron on your lawn, it looks good for a little bit, but in next to no time, of course, it's away again. You haven't actually got the whole thing. You've only burnt parts of it. Sulfate of iron on a lawn used continually, it's good to keep the worms out of the lawn because it makes it acidic, and worms don't like that, so you don't have worm casts if you've got a roller-type motor mower, lawn mower. And the disadvantage, of course, is if it becomes too acidic, it will affect the grass. So you need to actually lime your lawn occasionally. Okay. If you're using sulfate of iron.
I have great difficulty with lawn. And when I have planted a patch and managed to get a bit of a strike, it actually looks different grass. How do you get the same grass?
Well, you need to know what sort of grass you had originally. Right?
And with the greatest respect, how does one know that?
You would need to talk to a greenkeeper who can identify different types of grass per se. Then again, your grass, if allowed to mature, will seed, right? And you see these seeds, heads on your grass, particularly if you've got, and at certain times of the year as well. The danger with the grass that's seeded is that seed, if you use your grass clippings for compost, etc., will, and you don't get it hot enough, and then you use it in your gardens, you're going to have a lot of grass weed seeds popping up from the seed. But you probably heard of a dichonda, which some people use that as a lawn. Very low laying, et cetera, et cetera. And I've heard the stories that when it goes to seed, people get out there with a little hand vacuum cleaner and pick up all the seed and sell them for a horrendous price. They're like gold, man.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Dichonda lawn. It's probably not so popular anymore, but it was in the old days.
Okay. Now my big topic. I'm sitting there with space, Wally, fruit trees.
You're sitting there with space?
I've got space. I want to plant fruit trees, but I'm a bit scared. I'm a bit scared because the fruit trees aren't cheap.
No. Now, there's two ways about it. First of all, did I ever tell you the story about the old lady that had an orchard and had stone fruit, peaches, and nectarines, and she had no curly leaf?
No.
My God. This is one of my favorite stories. Yeah. I was talking to this elderly lady one time on the phone, probably a year or two ago, and the conversation got around to curly leaf.
As it does with young ladies.
With old ladies, yes.
Old ladies, yeah. Yes, yes.
Young ladies, so I'm not worried about their curly leaf.
Careful.
Not that I've come across anyway.
No.
And she said, I have no curly leaf in my orchard, right? And she said, I've got peaches and nectarines, et cetera, et cetera. I said, really? What do you do? She said, I don't do a thing. I said, She said, I've grown them all from stone. Now, here's a very interesting thing. You go and buy a peach or a nectarine or whatever at the supermarket and you say, oh, that's a lovely one, okay. And you take the stone and you allow it to dry and probably put it in the freezer, or not the freezer, but the fridge for a few weeks. And then you plant it in the ground where you want a tree to grow. And then you put a stake there so you know where it is, right? Most important. Otherwise, it's in the ground, and when it sprouts,
you'll mow it.
You know that's my nectarine that I'm going to grow, right? She said, I've grown them all from stone. Then she said, one time she went to a garden centre and she saw these cute little 1 metre high dwarf peach and nectarine trees. Right. She, oh, they look cute. I'll buy one of each. And she did. And she took them back and she planted them in her orchard. She said, I've had no end of problems with curly leaf on these two little dwarf trees, but it has never affected my other mature trees. It's never spread. Right? Interesting. So what is the difference between a stone grown and a grafted? Because those dwarfs are specially grafted to make them dwarfs, right? And all the fruit trees that you buy, which are named varieties, you know, like there's going to be Wally's Pride or whatever the name of the trees are, and they have guaranteed to have that exactly the same fruit as it's supposed to have, right? When you grow from a stone, what you get is debatable in nature, but it's still going to be a good fruit. In fact, all varieties of different types of apples, peaches, nectarines, et cetera, have all been grown originally from a stone. And then once they get a tree up and the fruiting, say, oh, that's a really good one, right? We'll call that Wally's Pride, and we'll graft, we'll take cuttings of it and we'll propagate it onto rootstock, et cetera, right? So to get a true tree, they have what we call rootstock. Rootstock is a tree and they are special ones in actual fact, which has grown and then either bud graft or they graft it onto that. And so you have that particular variety guarantee. My theory is grafting is a weakness. Even though it's joined and the tree grows, it is never a tree that has been grown from a stone. Yeah. So besides that, if you plant a stone, the root system will go way down the taproot and it spread out, right? So you've got a magnificent root system. The aspect of that will be a stronger, healthier tree. Now, there's a story that goes, oh, if you grow it from a stone or you throw a cherry pip out or something, it'll be years before they ever fruit. No, no. I've found personally, and the lady confirmed, no, within a couple of seasons or so, you'll have a small crop. They grow like billio. Once it sprouts, the sapling, what we call a young tree, will be up to your height in a season, and then the following season, it'll start to bear a small crop of fruit and only get better and better. Right.
So I wouldn't be paying $50, $60, $70 for a grafted old tree from Bunnings. I'd just go eat a peach and put it in the ground.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go to hell.
And okay, if you buy that grafted tree, you still, the first season, you might have a little bit of fruit because it's the wood that they use is fruiting wood. So, yes, you could have some fruit, but it's going to take just about as long as the stone grown to get yourself to a reasonable cropping state.
Mm.
So, and the advantage, of course, is the roots have got out. It's going to be much stronger, much healthier.
Because it wasn't in a bag.
Yeah, because coming out of a bag, you may find if it's been in the bag, the roots are twisted around at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And now this applies to anything you buy, any shrub, tree, etc. It's been in a bag and the roots are curled around. Some people try and tease the roots out. Stupid. Doesn't work. Right? Instead, you get your secateurs, and at the cardinal points, you cut through the spiral at the four cardinal points.
What is the cut? North, south, east, and west?
Yep. Cardinal points. You're on to it. You know your geographics. And then you put it into the ground. You don't tease the roots or anything. Now, because you've cut the roots.
Now, how do you cut them? Because, like, do you cut them at 90 degrees or to the face of the bulge?
You're cutting straight through that
the
ring.
Face. Of,
yeah. So you can, and your secateur is only going to cut about an inch.
Okay.
Anyway, right.
So you cut an inch off the material.
Yeah, at the four points.
To make it flat, really.
You're just cutting through. So it's still the spiral there, but it's been cut at four points. You follow?
Do I hold the secateurs flush to the potting mix and roots or at right angles?
You're doing it at right angles to the spiral roots.
Got it.
Right. So there's the root.
Yeah.
There. Right. Cut through. And you're only cutting into basically that spiral. It's an inch or so at the most.
Yeah.
When you put it into the ground, now, preparation of the hole is very important, right? This is where some people make a bad mistake, particularly if you've got a heavy clay soil, right? You dig a hole. Now, the hole is going to be smooth because the side of your spade is smooth, right? And so you end up with a hole with smooth sides, and the base is basically flat, right? Now, if you put your shrub or tree into that hole, later on, that clay will bake, and you've actually put it into a pot in the ground. It's become a pot. So when you dig your hole, you must cut down the sides of the hole so it's not round and smooth, right? It's broken. And the bottom of it should also zap, zap, zap with your spade a few times to break the bottom as well.
Okay.
That allows the roots to get out.
Okay. Now, so work over the sides and the bottom.
Yep, yep. Then the hole should be probably about 1.5 times bigger than what you need.
Yep.
Right? So the base of the hole, you're going to get some nice compost, either purchased or whatever, and you're going to put that at the base of the hole to build it up to the level so that the level that your tree is in the planter bag is going to be level with the ground, no deeper or whatever, right?
Yep.
Then you can sprinkle some sheep manure pellets or whatever. You don't want to put a lot of food there, but something mild like sheep manure pellets, maybe a little bit of biofoss, which is very good for root generation. If you've got some gypsum, you can sprinkle a bit of gypsum there, all good stuff. Then you sit the tree on top of that, and then you backfill with your nice compost.
Mm-hmm.
So the rest of the hole is filled up nicely. So it's got a nice area of compost to establish in, and then the roots will penetrate out into the soil surrounding. The idea too is, if you're in a windy situation, in the hole before you plant your tree, you would put a good firm stake. The stake should be on the off wind side of the tree. So if you're on a westerly wind, you've planted on the east side.
Oh.
Just let me think about this. No, it'd be blowing against the stake. No, you planted on the west side.
Okay, I got that. On the wind, we would say, in nautical terms, on the windward side.
Yeah, on the wind side. And then the tree was a nylon stocking or something that gives a bit of elasticity to it, you would support it while it's establishing so it doesn't get damaged with heavy wind. So that's all good. Now, The problem is, though, if you leave the stake in after the tree established, and I would suggest to leave the stake in for one season for sure, maybe two seasons, and then it's most important that you remove the stake. Because if you leave the stake, the tree doesn't become self-supporting. It depends on the stake, right? And that's bad because it's a weakness, and the stake's going to not give it support greatly. So by removing it, the tree then has to get buffered by the wind, which forms roots to counter that, and so it steadies itself and becomes strong in the soil as it grows.
And that stake applies to all trees?
As necessary. I mean, to say, now here's another one too. I'm not sure whether they still have them, but some grafted fruit trees are what we call rods. Now, a rod is just a straight up and down stick, right? It's grafted to rootstock at the bottom, but it's just like a branch goes vertical, right up, right? And we call that a rod. Now, I presume they're still around, but it used to be common in days gone by. Now, what you do with that when you get it home and you plant it, you cut the top few centimetres off the top of the rod, which causes the side branching to happen. Mm. Otherwise, you've got straight up in the air. What's that? With very little side branching.
Goodness me.
Waste of time. Now, here's another interesting one too with pruning. We may have talked about this last week, but a guy was saying to me, look, how do I keep my tree under control so it doesn't get too tall? And obviously, when you cut the end off a branch, it causes new branching, right?
Yeah.
So in a case like you've got the up trunk goes up. Now, if you top it, you're going to get a lot of side branches go up, which will be even taller than the original, right? Now, to overcome that, you remove most, if not all, of those side branches after they appear as small little side shoots, right? You just rub them out. That means you've actually held the tree at that height. It's got its other branches going out, of course.
Got it.
And once again, if it starts to hang over the neighbors or something like that, or over the footpath, whatever, if you cut the end off a branch, it's going to make new branches along the length of the branch to the left. So when you come to do that, you now must remove it from where it came from the trunk, and then there's nothing to create a new branch. Mm. But then again, you've got another problem. If you remove them all, you've just got that stake going up in the air.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of balance.
What about you're visiting your neighbours and they've got a nice peach tree? Can you take a cutting?
Normally, good, interesting point. I've never, and I'm not sure how well a cutting of a tree will grow. We probably would layer it. Do you know about layering?
No.
This is not what you do when you go to bed, layering.
This is a technical thing.
Like on a branch of a plant that you want, where you've got not hardwood, but what we call medium wood. It's not new growth, but it's fairly new growth, right? You with a knife, you just make a little nick, and then you get sphagnum moss, moist, and you wrap it around that bit there like that, and then with some tape or something, you affix it to that there. Now, roots will form in that sphagnum moss.
Oh, wow.
Right? And once you see, well, you leave it for a few months or a season or whatever, and then you can cut it off and you've got a little plant that's already rooted to plant into a pot or whatever. We have a thing called tree bands, right? Now, tree bands are used for controlling pests in like rhododendrons. It's very effective because rhododendrons have a fine bark on their trunk, right? So you have a 60-foot high rhododendron, right? And it's got thrips, which makes the leaves go silvery, right? And that's a scarring from their feeding. And it's too hard to spray up there. You could put neem granules on the ground. That helps, that's for sure. Or you get a tree band from us, which you cut to the right size so it wraps around the trunk, right? And then you take our Wally Super Neem Tree Oil and you don't dilute it. You spread the oil onto the tree band. The tree band is a couple of inches wide, right? Then you put that around the trunk and with a couple of drawing pins, you tack it on, hold it there, right? Now, the tree band has got plastic on the outside and it's got felt on the inside. The felt, of course, is where the oil is. What happens is the oil gets into the sap line and goes up through the whole of the 40-foot canopy, and anything feeding on the leaves will get a dose and stop eating and starve to death. Simple as that.
Wow.
It can't be used on, like, pine trees because the bark's too thick. You never get through it, right? Now, there's a danger, we say, when people use a tree band, is that you only leave it on for 1 month. If you leave it any longer, one or two things can happen. A, it could ring bark the tree and kill it. Or, as we've found, roots from the trunk start to grow into the bloody tree
it's
band.
Like the sphagnum moss.
Layered it.
Yeah. Amazing.
Another layering one is if you've got a branch that's near ground level that you can bend down and you can put part of the branch into the soil with a brick on top or something to hold it and leave it there like that for a period of time, and you can put the little nick in it as well, is layering. And a few months later you go back, you cut the branch off from the tree and you've got your little tree.
And presumably, if people weren't mowing around their fruit trees, you could find little seedlings that are sprouted?
Yeah. If stones or pips or whatever have fallen to the ground and they've gone through the cycle, usually it's a wintering. After winter, that's when they will germinate and sprout. Mm. Problem is, of course, unless you're looking, you're just likely to mow them off with your mower.
Now, go back to my, I love this idea of buying a box of cherries, a box of peaches. Can you do it with apple pips? Buying your favourite fruits and then planting them.
Now, the cherry one is one which I have done but not ended up with a decent cherry. I can presume that the beautiful cherries, black cherries and so forth you get from the South Island down your way, hybrids or something, but they don't come to a nice cherry fruit when they grow. Okay. But apples, now I had an uncle who's long passed. He had an orchard of citrus trees, beautiful trees, magnificent croppers and everything. And he was a returned soldier from the Second World War. And every one of those oranges and lemons and grapefruit, he grew from a pip.
Amazing.
Yeah. Beautiful orchard. As a kid, I was amazed.
Would you not be better to put them in a little pot rather than out on the ground?
No, because if you grow it in a pot, the roots will go only to the edges of the pot and the bottom of the pot, so you'll never get the root formation.
Got it.
So in the ground with a stake, so you know where it is, most important, otherwise you won't. And look, you could plant half a dozen. That's so cheap in the same spot. And then if they all germinate, you just pick the one that looks the best and pull the other ones out.
There you go. I love that idea because you could easily spend, you could spend hundreds of dollars growing fruit trees, right?
Yeah, well, I had an instance just recently. A chap rang me up. He said, I've been down to the garden centre and I bought myself a blah, blah, fruit tree. And they said to me, I've got to buy another one. And I said, why do I have to buy another one? And they said, oh, because of the pollinator. What? Now, yes, there is a certain amount of logic and reasons that if you've got two trees growing next to each other, the chances are the pollen will move between the two and you'll get a better crop. Yes. But generally speaking, one tree on its own, and I've done this countless times where I've had a plum or whatever just by itself, it fruits, and they're self-pollinating, etc. There's one of the interesting ones too. You can get doubly grafted or triply grafted, right? So you can have on the one rootstock, you can have two different varieties of plums or whatever, right? Now, the idea of that once again is that they will flower and help with the pollination. But the bloody things always, in my experience, flower at different times. It doesn't work.
Could you have an apple grafted with a peach?
You were talking about different wood stock or different wood. I remember in Hastings years ago, there was an orchard there and they had an apple tree in the front that had something like 40 varieties of apples on the same tree.
They had goodness.
Grafted so much, or bud grafted probably. But, it was an interesting specimen. Now, here's another point too, which I suggested that people could possibly do. Say you've got a rose, right? Now, roses, generally speaking, which are called high health roses, that are grafted, right, onto a rootstock, right? Now, there's no reason with your rose that you couldn't take a cutting from another rose, and then once again, a medium hardness cutting, and graft that on to your rose, and you could do that two or three times from different roses. So you could have a rose with three or four different coloured flowers on the same plant.
Goodness me.
You can do all sorts of interesting things.
Is grafting must be an old, old practice, right? It's not like a modern thing.
Yep.
Isn't that amazing?
It's the only way you can easily get a true form. So say, for instance, here's an interesting one with roses. This time of the year after it's finished flowering, you've got what we call rose hips, right? Those red or orange round things where the flower used to be. Mm-hmm. And it's got rose seeds inside that there. Now, rose hips, as you know, there used to be years ago rose hip syrup, which was very good for your health. And you can make rose hip syrup from these roses, rose hips, rose pods and rose seeds. Or you can take that and you can take the seeds out, allow them to dry on a windowsill or something. Then you put them in the fridge for, I think it's about 3 or 4 weeks, right? And then you bring them out and you sprout them. And for something like this, you just sprout them in a seedling tray and so forth. Once they sprout, you pop them up, etc. I did it one time when I had a nursery. I was actually at the cemetery at the crematorium, and they had a rose garden there, well fertilized with all the ashes of people, of course, but to the point that the roses started to die, I think. But I collected rose hips and took them and germinated them, and I grew very quick. They sprouted, and a small rose plant with a flower, very early flowering, and I'd sell these for $1 each.
Goodness me.
Unnamed varieties.
And so you only get a true rose that you want if it's grafted.
Grafted, yeah. And that's how they do it. A rose breeder will grow from seed a whole pile of roses, right?
Yes.
Once they get up into flowering size, etc., he will look and see how good the plants are, whether it's got good colour flower, whether it's got whatever, right? He will then take the ones which are really good and name them and register them. And then to propagate from there, it would be done from cuttings or alternately grafted.
Got it. Now, I recall some time ago you telling me that you're a movable tree man.
A movable tree man?
Tree. That you like your fruit trees movable.
Oh yeah. The situation was a few years back where I was living above a warehouse. It was all concrete outside. And having 200 litre drums, which I bring neem oil in from India, and a few other products, cut in half, you've got a 100 litre pot. Now, ideally, you don't put holes in the bottom for drainage. You put them in the sides near the bottom, which gives a reservoir. You fill it up with compost, and you plant your tree in that. And I had all my trees, and there was a big pile of them, different varieties and so forth, apples, you name it, in those containers. And when I moved to Martin, I took the best of them. I got the forklift, handy having a forklift.
Yeah.
Very good gardening tool. I highly recommend everybody should have a forklift in their shed for gardening, especially with big containers. And, yeah, put them back on the back of a truck, took them to Martin, took them off the forklift and spread them around the section. It's also...
And you still, even when you had a section, you still kept them in the drum?
Yeah, I've still got some in there, what's dangerous, because I can move them around, per se.
Tell me, that's like a 200-litre oil tank, you know.
Yeah, but plastic, not metal.
Oh, not metal. Metal wouldn't work?
It would rust.
But
plastic, well, in those type of drums that you buy, 200-litre drums, plastic. The plastic is very, very rigid and very strong, and I've not actually found one to deteriorate with sunlight yet.
And do you just put compost in it?
Yeah.
Fill it up?
Yep, compost and ice compost.
And you'd have to water it. You'd have to water it always.
Yeah, of course, yes. Now, another aspect which I did one time, I lived in a particular place where the backyard would actually be a lake in the wintertime, right? The drainage was poor, etc. And I wanted to grow citrus. Now, if I planted citrus into that in the winter, they'd be dead as a doorknob. So once again, I took the 200-litre drums and cut them in half, 100 litres, put some holes in the bottom and in the sides down near the bottom, dug a hole, so I half buried them into the ground, and then I planted my citrus tree in compost inside the half
drum.
So
you kept them up dry.
Right. So most of the root situation was above water, right? And it could be a lake. And they were happy as Larry there.
How funny.
When I came to move them, of course, the roots had gone out through the drainage holes. And so I had to cut those roots to be able to lift them and move them, which knocked them back quite a bit. The other problem was having plants like trees, shrubs, roses in containers, is that at some point of time after X amount of years, they become root bound. Now, root bound means they will die, right? So every 2 or 3 years, and ideally it's done in winter time, is you take the tree out of the container, which is quite a bit job if you've got a 100-litre container and you've got a good-sized tree. But if you've got a forklift, no problems at all. Because what you do is you wrap a towel around the trunk and you get your chain onto the twine of the forklift and you lift the whole thing off the ground, pot and all. And once it's off the ground, you just tap the pot, and particularly if it's a bit more, you give it a drink first. Pot comes away, good. You lay your tree down on the ground.
There you go.
On its side. And then you get your cross saw and you cut through the bottom third of the roots, right? And then with your container, you fill compost at the bottom up to that third that has been removed. And then put some goodies in, sheep manure pellets, et cetera, et cetera. And then plunk it back in, and it generates on a whole lot of new roots, and it comes away, and you get some really good growth out of it. And you can do that with roses, fruit trees, whatever. The only problem is if you don't have a forklift, you need 2 or 3 fairly strong people, men ideally, to be able to lift it up bodily and off the ground so you can tap the pot away and then lift it completely out. Forklift is so ideal.
When you were living above the warehouse with concrete gardens, did you have hens?
Yes. There was one little patch behind the warehouse which was dirt, right? In fact, it was weed. It was, and it was well fenced off because of security fences, and we were living right next to a stream, so you had the banks, the high banks.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it was only like about 1.5 meters wide and about 5 meters deep. It was the only bit of dirt there. So I set up a chook house on the concrete. I had a run with wire netting, which would take them to that area, and then they went into that area, no problems at all. And that worked perfectly.
Can I tell you that I can't imagine now not having hens?
Oh, it would be life without.
Yeah, I was terrified of them. And now I've got them. I just can't imagine. I actually enjoy hens enormously now. I find it the strangest thing because they're so good to me, laying eggs. And my daughter, whose hens they are, and I sort of help out, and she pays her little brother money to help do the duty jobs, exploits them mercilessly. She's actually got a wee bit of income coming in. She's quite enjoying it, running her wee business.
I have a hen that lays very small eggs, right? And this is no joke because there's no yolk.
Ah.
Yeah, it's only the white. And, every time, well, most of the time, it's this half-size egg and there's no yolk, just the whites, which is very good if you make pavlovas.
The hens all go into, I got, you know, I don't know, 8 or 9 nesting boxes. They all nest in one, just about.
Yeah.
Is that the way it goes?
Yeah, yeah. And if they're free ranging, they will find somewhere outside to lay the eggs. And this is why we have, at Easter time, egg hunts. That's the practicing.
It's not a problem. There's not something wrong with them, or I'm not doing something wrong, that one nesting box has eight eggs in it, and you'll be lucky to find an egg in one other box.
Yeah, they're creatures of habit, and my ones at the moment, even though there's a nesting box area in the hen house, but it's only the one without the yolk that usually lays there, and sometimes another one will, but there's two spots currently outside which I've learnt, and I collect the eggs from that. Now, there's a good reason for this. A nesting box is not suitable for raising chickens in. Why? Because a nesting box has got no moisture, but the ground has. So when they have fertile eggs, which means you've got to have a rooster, they will lay their eggs on the soil somewhere in a sheltered position, under a shrub or whatever, right? And then the eggs, when they're sitting on them, will get some moisture up from the ground, which will keep the shells softer so the little chickens can peck their way out. If you had them in a non-moist area, you've actually got to spray the eggs every few days to make them the shells softer while the hens are laying on them, or otherwise they'll never peck their way out.
Does a hen know whether its egg's fertilised or not?
No, they don't, because they'll get what we call clucky, and a clucky hen, and bantams are very good at being clucky, will sit on eggs that are no good until they explode. They go rotten.
Wow.
Which you know what you do with rotten chook eggs?
Throw them at the Prime Minister?
Yes, that's not a bad idea. Mm-hmm. But they're ideal for eeling. You take them down and you crack them open and into the stream, and it brings the eels up.
Okay. Well, it'd be good for my rat trap too, and stoat trap.
Yeah.
Well, hens are a fascinating creature. My daughter raised some from a day old. Now, they're literally born the day she got them, five of them, and we had them inside, little wee lovely wee chicks, and then they got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and then we started, you know, being a nuisance. And I've just put them out in their own run. I've kept them separate, and it gets -5, -6, -7. And then it doesn't even bother them. And you're thinking, my God, we have wrapped the little one's coop so it's nice and warm. But, man, it's cold up there. And these little things tuck their head under their wings and you're thinking, I don't know how they do it. Now, what happens when I introduce five new hens to my existing flock?
Interesting. If they are different to the ones you've got,
same species, same brown shaver.
Yeah. What I've found with the brown shavers is that I brought in new hens and they've settled down fairly quickly.
Yeah.
But if I introduce, say, a white chook or black chook or a different breed, they get picked on really bad.
Wow, little racist. Yeah.
They are definitely racist, chooks are, yes, definitely. And it takes a while to get the pecking order, which is a term
literally
that is used.
I'm thinking I won't introduce these hens, these ones that we raised, until they're fully matured. Would that be a correct procedure?
And, yeah, coming to what we call the point of laying.
Okay.
Yeah, is a good time because then they can look after themselves and so forth.
Yeah. I've got
well.
them side by side, but separated by netting.
Oh, well, they talk to each other already.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's good. That's good. Oh, before we finish up with your company, let's talk a little bit about glass houses and tunnel houses, what people should be doing at the moment.
Yes, please.
Right. Most important, a new season. Probably they're clear of plants and so forth, maybe some weeds if they grow in the open ground in there. It's a good idea to burn some sulfur powder. That fumigates the house. So what you do is you get the powdered sulfur, yellow sulfur, you put it on through a harsh shovel or spade or a steel plate. You light it, difficult to light, you need a strong flame. And if it's difficult to light, you put a little bit of methylated spirits on part of it, like that, and then get out of the house, all closed up, leave it like that for 24 hours, open it up, let it vent. Now, what I found last year, it was a very interesting thing. I did an experiment because I've got two glass houses. I decided this year, or last year, I will plant tomatoes solely in one, and the other one I'll do my capsicums and chilies and eggplants, etc., right? Now, my theory was that it's the tomatoes that attract the whitefly, and it is. It worked because my other glass house, I didn't do anything, and I didn't have any whitefly, right?
Mm.
But in this one, I had a tip from a lady up north who had taken out cat repellent, which is naphthalene, and she'd got some tea bags that used. She'd cut them open, tipped the old leaves out, put the naphthalene flakes inside the bag and stapled it up, and she hung it in her fruit tree to create a smell to stop the guava moth from finding the tree, right? And she said it worked a treat. And I thought, good idea. So in the glass house, I went to the second, to the $2 shop, and they have little gauze bags, right, which they use for putting some lollies in or whatever gift. So I got a few of those, put the naphthalene in, hung them up in that glass house with the tomato plants, and I also hung up some yellow sticky traps, whitefly traps, right? Now, during the whole season, no whitefly, none.
My goodness.
It was marvellous. And the yellow sticky pads caught other insects, but no whitefly. Whitefly were not attracted because the smell of the naphthalene overrode the smell of the tomato plants, so the whitefly flying by didn't know there was any plants there.
Did you have to change the naphthalene?
No, it lasted till the end of the season, basically. It was slowly evaporating. They were hung up so they didn't get wet. Otherwise, they would have been gone very quickly. But like mothballs, they last a long time. In fact, mothballs were naphthalene, which now are illegal. Excellent thing to do, and you can be free of whitefly in your glass house in the season by that little trick.
And where does a gardener get sulfur from to burn?
Oh, we have sulfur powder, 500-gram bags, so they can buy it from us.
What's your number again?
The website. Is www.0800-466-464.co.nz. Same as our phone number.
0800-466-464. There you go. I have rung it so many times I almost know it. There you go. We've been speaking with our gardening professor, Tom Lade, I think it's the phrase. Guru, PhD, gardening, Wally Richards. Wonderful session, Wally. Thank you so much. We've learned such a lot talking to you, and it's always fun. You have a great day, Wally.
Thank you. Yep. And thank you all.
There you go. That was Wally Richards. You're on Rally Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Remember, send us a text, 2057. Email me, inbox at rallycheck.radio. Thank you so much for listening. Gosh, well, he's a fund of information.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.